In the interest of time, let's get started. Good morning. So last time we looked at the vector instructions. We learned about CMD. Then you had the lab. And at least, I don't know about you, but the first few times I learned about vector instruction, I was thinking, oh. I can write so much better code. I guess I could have used this there, there, there. So probably you had the same ideas going through your mind. Oh, my previous code can now be accelerated by these vector instructions. So we learned how to use them first with assembly. We've seen how the assembly looks like. We've seen how we actually code a specific instruction, vector instruction, and vector registers, how we use those. And then we learned how to use them in C, with this C intrinsic functions, right? Wrap them in C. We applied then the C intrinsic functions to do matrix multiplication. And we learned a bit about the history of these vector instructions, they're a very good idea, which is why they exist in many other instruction sets. And then we learned how GPUs, we briefly mentioned the GPUs are these vector instruction specialized CPUs. So when you buy a GPU, it comes with CUDA cores. What is a CUDA core? Probably a few other things, but mostly it's this core with this vector instruction set architecture. And it's optimized to do that well and fast. And just multiply matrices and multiply vectors together, or add them and so on. Well, we briefly look at profiling just to give a hint on how to approach optimization problems, to look at, when we approach a we want to speed something up, we first want to see what is actually slow and then try to attack that. We learned about context switching and exception handling done by the operating system, and we just briefly learned about this. So today we're going to basically do that. We're going to cover this this topic and see how it's quite connected with virtual memory. And we'll learn about virtual memory as well. Before I even go into exceptions and virtual memory, I want to make this distinction. So we were writing our own processor in HCLRS, right? We were implementing the five-stage processor, and then we were running some instructions, sometimes pen on paper, sometimes simulating that. And the instructions were just running directly on the processor as we were saying. So the program was not really managed by anything. It was just alone on the processor. And that type of run is sometimes referred to as bare metal. The application runs directly on the processor, directly on hardware. Now, most of the times, and the ones we're most familiar with, is that applications run inside an operating system. They run in this controlled environment. And the operating system does a lot. And all of it is quite useful. It does task scheduling, so we can run more than one program, and we don't have one program just overtaking the entire hardware and never allowing anything else to run. So that's what task scheduling is very good for. And then context switching is also done by the processor, so it changes from one context to another, from one program to another, and can do this many, many times. We learned that operating system does memory management, so it does memory protection. We don't want a program to use to override operating system or memory space of a different program. Then there is interrupts, handles interrupts and exceptions. We'll learn today more about that. And some examples, operating system we're all familiar with, right? Right here is Windows. We all know macOS, Linux, Android on the phone, iOS and so on. While examples for bare metal would be some more dedicated embedded systems, microcontrollers, something that has to be real-time. So real-time system is usually a time-critical runtime. For example, in a car, you don't want an operating system to delay your acceleration or your brake. You want that to be a real-time reaction, and you don't want, somebody's SSHing into my brake, so let me just not brake, right? We don't want that to happen. So that's basically what a real-time system is. It's a program, a process that runs bare metal on the hardware and handles all the hardware on its own. We looked briefly at this example, and I'll resume from there, where we have a loop, and this loop alone, it sees that it's executing. It doesn't really see this interrupt. But there is a space when the loop is not executing. So if the loop actually measures time, it will be quite surprised because, well, it measured time at the beginning, it measured time at the end, and turns out it took millions of seconds. So there was something in between here, and that was not the loop problem. The loop was just supposed to run uninterrupted. But it did get interrupted. And what happened is that something interrupted that loop and ran something else in between. So there was this SSH routine that happened, right? And in addition, Firefox started. And at some point, it went back to the loop. And then again, it went to SSH. And that something that interrupted it was the operating system. So the operating system received an exception or an instruction or an interrupt, and then it followed a procedure according to that interrupt. So the interrupt could be that the network interface, the Ethernet, raised this one bit interrupt. For example, there is a request here, you have to handle it, and then the operating system decided, okay, it's an interrupt, this has high priority, I will switch the context from the loop to handling this interrupt. And the interrupt instruction was start this SSH procedure, program. And that's what it did. So when an exception happens, as I said, the operating system will handle it. So there is some hardware support for this to make this simpler, but it is handled by the operating system. I see some eyes confused. Questions, maybe? So when we switch context, when we switch from loop to SSH to Firefox, what is a context? If you think of our processor implementation, five stage, register file, program counter. So the register values are part of the context. The program counter is part of the context. The condition codes, so if we store all of those somewhere else, and then we bring them back, it's like we halt and resume the flow of the program. So that's our state, right? And that's our context, our state. And we can store it somewhere and resume it again. And there's a pseudo code here, but also the image. We went through this last time as well. It's a little simpler to understand. So like in the previous slide, in the CPU, we have these values for the registers, for the condition codes, for the program counter. And these values really describe, so these values here, they define the context of this process A. And if we want to switch to process B, in the operating system memory, we have the processor, a context for that process. So if we simply overwrite, well, we store this somewhere there, and then because we don't want to delete them, right? We don't want to lose them. But we overwrite the processor values with this context values of process B, then we're going to end up switching the context to process B. And the operating system handles this. And there is some hardware support, but it's mostly handled by the operating system. Now, there are lots of things we have to be careful about. And one of them is memory protection. And last time I tried to, I got somewhat lost in these nuances here, but I think I can make it much clearer now. So what's happening in these programs here? So we have two programs, program A and B. And program A has this variable at this address, has a value basically, 42. That's the value at address in hex 10000. And it does some work, but eventually it will move that value from that address in memory into RAX, into register RAX. Now, this line runs, and then the operating system will, it so happens that the operating system does a context switch. So there's gonna be a context switch to program B after this line. So after this line, we're gonna switch to program B, and these two instructions will run. And then after those two instructions run, there will be a switch back, a context switch back to program B. That's what we want to think about in this in these two problems. So on the same hardware, on the same CPU, one core, we have two programs. They are gonna be time multiplexing. So the first one starts to run, then we switch to the second one, to program B, and then we go back to program A. And this second program, it moves value 99 into RAX, and then it moves RAX into this address, 1000. That address is the one that we are actually moving into RAX. So, seems like there might be something going wrong here, right? That program B might be interfering with the address and the values of program A. So the question is, what's the result? What's the RAX at the end in program A? What is the value of RAX at the end here? And last time we somewhat agreed that it's 42, that it's not going to be 99. Also because, well, take a hint from the slide title, it's called memory protection. The program A memory in some way is protected, and we're gonna learn how that works. Because the memory is protected, because the program A memory cannot be written by program B, we will always get 42 at the end here. Now what happens in program B, it might actually write this RAX to some memory location. It will probably, most probably, 100%, not be physical location, physical address 10000. It will be a different address. Or it just might crash. It might say, well, that address is actually not in your address space. So those are the two options. Yes, please.
If it doesn't crash, would program B just like replace every instance of that address with like a different address that it knows is free? Or like how would that work?
If it doesn't crash, will program, the question was, if it doesn't crash, will program B replace every instance of that address? It will replace the instance of that address that is in the memory, the address space of this program. So we will learn soon that there is the physical address, and then each program has their own virtual address space. And the first one might go somewhere here, and the second one somewhere there. So this 1000 might be this location right there, while the other 1000, it could be somewhere here, or it could be somewhere else, somewhere outside the boundary, maybe in the operating system, maybe. And because it's outside, somewhere else, that will raise an exception. The exception will be, well, you do not have rights to, so segmentation fault. This address is not in your address space, no permission. Yeah. So I was just drawing more or less that. And so your question was a very good intro to this slide. Each program thinks that they have this memory space. Each program kind of, from the program's perspective, this is what the program sees, and this is what the program knows. So when you write some code, this is what you think. Well, there is an operating system, there is stack, there is heap, there is writable data, and so on, and there are some constants. And from a program's perspective, this is what the memory address space looks like. But we have more programs, and each of them, from their perspective, see this. But physically, we interleave these addresses. So used by OS might be the same, but then the two stacks could be that there will be one stack there, so the other stack here. Then the heap, similarly, there will be some space in the memory. Oh, a little imprecise. And so on. So physically, they will be using distinct physical address space in the memory. And to draw one more diagram, so remember we had our processor pipeline. So that these are the five stages, program counter. And then we were interfacing with the cache. And then there is the whole bigger memory, the DRAM, for example. So there is cache hierarchy and so on. So now we're gonna have some sort of thing in between that says, oh, you're accessing, the program wants to access this specific memory, but actually, so the program wants to access this specific page. Well, we have to translate this from virtual memory to physical memory. So when the processor accesses the cache, there will have to actually be a translation so that the program doesn't just access the physical memory. It goes either to either one or the other of these spaces here. And we will learn today a bit more about this block here. But yeah. Essentially, program A addresses will be, the program A will be making a memory operation, a read or a write, and first the operating system will map that operation to physical real memory, to physical memory. So the address that the program will be accessing, read or write, physically will actually be a different. And if the address that they are accessing physically is not in their memory space, in the program space, we'll just raise an exception. That will be an exception. That's that trigger error over there. So there is more to it, but let's think for now about it in this sense, that if program A accesses some of this code here, perfectly fine. Some of this other code here, similarly, no problem. But any other address will go into an error. We'll raise an exception. And we refer to that, to this we refer to this memory that the program sees, we refer to it as virtual memory. And it's really just a very simple translation, virtual memory, and we will see how that works, but it's not like there is a very complicated algorithm. It's a way to segment the physical memory for multiple programs. And that's how we end up with this virtual memory, and we call the mapping mechanism or the mapping addressing scheme, we call that a page table. We have a table that we'll see how it actually looks like. What's important, I would like to make this remark here. When we do context switching, we mentioned how we define the context of a program as the state of the processor. There are the register values, the program counter, and there is the condition codes. But why not the memory? Shouldn't we store the memory values somewhere to the disk and then read them back? Well, turns out we don't have to. All we have to do is we already have the memory in the physical memory. The pages, the virtual memory is already there. So all we have to do is load the different context and then use the different pages. So the memory is already there. So doing context switching and having virtual memory, they go along perfectly. That's a quite an efficient way to do context switch. We don't have to do any of this memory back and forth. Well, one more remark is, and we will learn a lot more about this in detail today. If a program would like to access memory, so read or write, to this location here, to this address space here, the operating system data. So that will not necessarily trigger an error. It probably will if it doesn't have the right permissions. But the idea is that with the right permissions, that is possible. And that is what we call kernel mode. So if the program has the right permissions or makes a request or a system call using this kernel mode level or priority, then that will be allowed. So let's go a little more in detail of this terminology. What we call a process? So we learned about a program. A program is a list of instructions, basically. And then a process is two things together, a thread and an address space. And let's split those two a little bit in detail. So a thread, if this is the timeline on a processor, so time. So for a while we have loop, and then we switched to SSH. Back to loop. So what we really did is we did time multiplexing. And if we run two programs on one core, we could refer to this as a thread. That the program itself sees that, well, it's running, but there are multiple things running on the processor. It's time multiplexed, but we could refer to this as a thread. And somehow in my understanding, when I refer to threads, sometimes I have this tendency to go confused. Well, a thread should be something parallel on hardware. A thread should have a spatial. So it doesn't have to be. A thread can be just a temporal, time multiplexing, right? So it's one core. It can also be that we have two threads and each of them is on different processors. That is indeed very much parallel. But in this case, we want to say we have one core, and we want each program to be able to run on that core. And to do that, we do time multiplexing, and the program will have the illusion of having a CPU, and that illusion of having a CPU, or its own CPU, we call it a thread. So this is this definition here. And then we also just mentioned the illusion of its own memory. So the program doesn't access the physical memory. It accesses a certain location that is managed by the operating system, and there is a translation going on. But it has the illusion that it has its own memory, and nobody else can mess with that memory, can read or write to it, right? So it's a safe, protected memory space just for that one program, and that is that illusion of own memory, that's this address space, this virtual memory. So that's why we define a process. It's having this thread and having this virtual dedicated memory for one program. And I think in Windows, they call it, so this is not exactly the same. So this is a task manager, and these have tasks. And there's a reason why this is not a very good example. It's not really the same thing. But if you run top in Ubuntu, you see a PID, and I think this is much closer to that. It's a processor, a process ID, which is running several processes, and they all have, take a certain amount of time on the CPU core, and they all take some memory. So yes, go ahead. I don't know if that's 100% all correct.
So just to make sure, the thread that you drew at the top right, the different colors, that's like the program A code, program B code, program A. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so this would be our loop. For example. And then this would be our SSH. And yeah, they each take some time on the processor, and they will be context switched by their operating system. Okay. Yes, please.
So we're calling these like the single process an illusion because we know that it's not true if they have their own CPU and memory.
Yes.
There can be multiple processes going on simultaneously.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Are threads similar to like what you would see in like a higher level language where like it's associated with concurrency and things like that?
Are these threads what we would see similar to high-level language. I think there's a lot of confusion if we go that route. Yes, Charles.
For the threads, you usually see them.
Okay.
Usually they are kind of
so when we do when we use a fork, I think, is that going to give us? And they will also have their own virtual memory.
No. If you order process, it's threads.
Plus other space. Yeah, there we go. That's a very important.
We're not going to talk about multiple threads more in this class, which is why you didn't prefer that, but that's an OS.
Yeah. Okay. So it's multiple threads and an other space. That's great. Good question, remark, discussion. Let's talk a bit more about exceptions. So there are two types of exceptions that we are going to be thinking. We'll think of exceptions as there are two types of them. There's the asynchronous, which are not triggered by the running program. And then there's the synchronous, which are triggered by the current program. So let's look at some examples. So one type of exception is interrupts. These are something coming from the hardware. It could be the keyboard or the Ethernet card, serial device. I think it used to be that the mouse used to have interrupts, but now they are using a USB different approach. So these are externally triggered. They have quite a high priority, so they will actually interrupt the execution of a program. So if an interrupt arrives, the operating system will immediately switch to handling a routine that corresponds to that interrupt. And that routine could simply be read one character from the keyboard. That could be it, the whole routine. So we spoke about the IO devices already. And a board, think of it as the system. Oh, we have a question, sorry.
Sorry, back to the previous slide. So thread, it just stores the memory of each of the program.
So the thread is a virtual CPU, right? It's like an illusion of a CPU. So it's time on the CPU. You're confusing a little bit. So a thread, so you have only one core, and we have 10 seconds. if in each second you're running a different program, then you have 10 threads. That's what a thread is. So you're doing time multiplexing on those, on that time budget we have. That's what a thread is. Now, each thread, or the in the process, all the threads can access a certain address space. And that makes it a process. So a process can have multiple threads and an address space. Is it true that on the real CPU, I'm not sure I fully understand the question. The CPU can't really multitask, but we get the illusion. Is that the question?
Yeah.
I believe the answer would be yes. The CPU would like to start a program and execute that program until the end. And when it ends, I don't know, hopefully there is a new program to start, or if there's nothing then. But that would be terrible, right? The user experience would be not that great. You would want to open a file and say, no, I'm not hiding something here, or I'm busy now. So it would basically be very unresponsive. So that's why when the user interacts with the machine, there are interrupts that switch the context. And it immediately will do the other action with the higher priority. Well, just we'll do the other action. But we are only talking about, we're speaking here about one CPU. Now in real life, we have multiple cores. So CPU cores could be 32, 18, 128, quite a lot of them, right? And that will help even more with multitasking, because now we can have a thread physically located on a different CPU. Yes.
So then just to make sure that I'm understanding what a thread is correctly, in this example, we have three threads on one CPU.
Two threads.
Okay.
Yeah, we have two threads on this example. Yes, please. Yes.
So I'm actually trying to understand the big picture here. So basically with one process, it's like you're drawing out your own processor with the threads, each processor is different, and then you have your own memory, and it's like lecture one where we map out the CPU to the memory,
can you please repeat the question?
So basically, if you were to draw it out, one process specifically, it would be you have multiple different processors, and each of them can use their own memory, and then that's one process.
So we're talking about only one processor here, one CPU. Okay, not more of them.
Okay.
More of them would make it maybe a little more complicated, but think of it as just one processor.
Okay.
And you want to run multiple things, for example, two things, as in this example, and you run one of them for some time, and then you switch to a different thread, to a different program. Yeah, and you run the other one for some time, and you could have a scheduler. So the operating system could actually have a scheduler. Say you have two very long duration programs, or you want to encrypt something and also you want to compress something else. So you're doing two big data operations at the same time. You could do one and then the other, but maybe that would be less, not sufficient, not good in terms of user experience. What would a user care about? For example, you have a video file and an audio file, and you would like to watch and listen both. So you would have a thread for the video and another thread that does the audio. And if you switch really fast between them, then technically you can provide both the sound and the video. That would be one process that contains two threads, video and sound, and it has access to a certain memory where the video and the sound is. Is that a good example? Does it answer the question?
Yeah, so there's only one memory too, right? Like memory.
Yeah, if you have more processes, they will use different memory, physical memory pages, but for one of them, we have, from the process perspective, it has its own memory and there is nothing else, but then physically, there are other things, and it's basically a memory bucket, a memory page, a section of the memory, a segment of the physical memory. Thank you. So I wanted to mention what happens during this. So if the hardware is broken, the operating system might have a self-diagnosis routine, and it will notice that there's the hardware is broken. For example, if you short some pins at the I/O, instead of running something silly or damaging the entire processor, so it might just raise an error and could go to a safe state, so that it doesn't damage the hardware. Then we have synchronous exceptions. The first one is this TRAMS, and that is intentionally triggered exceptions. For example, system calls. So if you're running Hello World and you want to print something to the standard output, then you wouldn't just hijack the standard output and say, I am a program that has the right to do that. Because, no. You would ask the operating system kindly, is it available and may I please output this to the standard output? And the operating system will handle it from there. And that will actually trigger an exception that the operating system will be handling. And that's what we refer to as system calls and traps. And then there is faults. And if a program accesses a memory that is not in its address space, that's a segmentation fault. And that's basically memory protection. So that's one example of a fault. And it is generated by the current running program, right? So that's why it's synchronous. Another one is a privileged instruction. For example, a program wants to access the hard drive. Well, the hard drive is an input-output, but it also has to handle data, for example, a file system. If a program wants to read from a file or write to a file on the hard drive, has to go through the file system, and does it even have the right to modify that file? So that should be a privilege instruction, right? And that is also handled by the operating system. Other faults, divide by zero is an example of a fault, or an invalid instruction, an instruction that might run on a different ISA but not on this one. That's an invalid instruction, so that's going to be a fault. So how does the operating system, business?
On the previous slide, are all those asynchronous exceptions, like those will stop all the processes on the CPU, but a synchronous one will only stop the process that triggered it?
So it won't really, so there will be a specific way that they're handled. It's not, you cannot just conclude that any of these will stop. That's false. Any of this will raise an exception, and then the operating system will have to handle it. And it will handle it according to a specific, each operating system knows how to handle each exception. So Windows, or Linux, or Mac OS. Oh, there's a key press. That's an exception. Not going to stop anything. It will just handle that one exception. Oh, there is water on the keyboard. That's an exception, right? That's a time to abort. Then it will actually stop. Then it will have to go into a safe state. And this is how it does that work. So we just had this question. Will an exception have to stop whatever is running on the processor? Well, sometimes, but it will have to stop according to this exception handler programs, or logic, or subroutines. So there is an exception table, and this table can be somewhere in the memory of the operating system. And when an exception occurs, that exception has an ID, a keyboard interrupt might be one ID, an Ethernet coming from the SSH, an Ethernet interrupt might have another ID, and based on that ID, the processor will run either this handler code or this other handler code. And there is probably a lot of different handler for different exceptions. That's how the operating system handles all. I will skip these guys. So the next few slides are bit of a mouse, cat and mouse, right? So the attacker, we want to bulletproof something, but then maybe imagine there is a malicious attacker that would like to bypass that. So for example, we have this exceptions, and we have an exception handling routine in the operating system. Well, so okay, that will mean that if we run that code, that while loop, then we will not be able to hijack the portal server. But what if we create our own handle interrupt, and we just say the code for that is return back from exception? Well, so basically we have that while loop, and if there is ever an exception, so before this while one, we will have to write to that exception table. I think there is actually a slide for that. Yeah. So there is this exception table, and we will be, what a program that tries to set the exception table. So we set to that exception table, use my own exception table, and the idea here would be that it would make the while loop, whenever there is an exception, go back to the program itself, so it will not really switch to the SSH. And in this way, we're running the loop, and then we would like to switch to the SSH, but because the exception, so ideally we would switch to the SSH here. So ideally we would switch to the SSH, but how does that happen? That happens because we have the operating system handling that exception, and the exception says, go there. But now we are overwriting this, so we are the orange, we are whose, and we say the exception should actually be stay here. So instead of switching to SSH, we stay in our loop. So we have our loop and running on portal, and instead of we change the exception, and then instead of it going to SSH, it will basically go back to the loop. And in this way, we should be able to own portal just for ourselves. But the problem here is that we are trying to write this exception table, and that will need a privilege instruction. Meaning, we cannot just modify the exception table. We don't have the right to do that. That can only be done with a privileged instruction, and that's how we learn about these two modes, kernel mode and user mode. So a privileged instruction means that we cannot let any program run some instructions. And here are some examples. Setting the exception table. We cannot do that unless we have that privilege instruction. Operating system can do it, but we cannot. Changing or setting the address space of our program, or interfacing with the I/O devices, hard drive, keyboard, and so on. So so there is a kernel mode and user mode. So a processor has these two modes. How do we know in which mode we are in? We have a bit register, a one-bit register, a flag. So each instruction will also have this flag. Is it being run in the user mode or in kernel mode? Each program will have that instruction. So we did have this slide before, and we're repeating now this slide. We can, if a program wants to access data from the operating system, it can only do that if we are in this, if the instructions are in kernel mode, if they have this flag, this one bit kernel mode bit set to one. So here's an exercise. Which operations are likely to fail, meaning to trigger an exception to run the operating system instead, if attempted in user mode? So let's see. A, reading data on disk by running special instructions that communicate with a hard disk device. So imagine that your program will run some special instructions that will read data from the disk. Do you think this will trigger an exception? Exception? No exception? So I say it does, it triggers an exception. Why is that the case? Well, imagine we read some information, some data that we're not supposed to. Operating system data, passwords. There are other users using that that machine, so data from other users, from their file system, from their disk. So that will raise an exception for sure. Changing a program's address space to allocate it more memory. If we run this in user mode, will we have an exception? You say yes. Anyone says no? You say no. Why do you say no?
Because I think it's like normal to have more memory.
So you would like a program to be able to change the size of its own stack? Heap address space. You think that happens?
Yeah, if it produces like more data, like new data, it will need some more space.
So if it needs that more space, can it just do it alone without any arbiter, without permission?
Oh, okay.
That's the question.
Okay.
That is the question, and it can do that by asking the operating system to allocate it more space. It will do the malloc.
How does the operating system know how much space to allocate for a particular program?
The program requests a certain amount of space. I think that's usually how it works. So when you run malloc, you usually say, give me this much space.
Okay.
Yeah. You usually say, give me size of this array. Right? That's how malloc works.
So in the user mode, this will cause an exception.
In the user mode, it will cause an exception, but that doesn't mean that we just crash. So don't think of exception as this thing that just breaks everything. Exception is something that can be managed. So it's in user mode, the program requests more address space, raises an exception, then the operating system will handle that exception. Will say, okay, no problem. Here's your space. Yeah, or but there's no space. Abort. If you run out of space, then I guess there's just no more space. Yeah. So C, returning from a standard library function. So we're running a program and it's returning from a standard library function. Will that issue an exception? No, right? That seems to be pretty routine, right? Yeah. I agree with you. Implementing the stack pointer. No, so this is something that the program has the illusion of having its own stack. It's on the stack, it has its own stack, right? Okay, so we just went through these. So what will the kernel actually give us? So when we run it in, when a process or a program needs to request something from the kernel, what are some of the services that the kernel can provide? So we spoke about allocating memory. We spoke about accessing files on the disk in the file system. Reading I/O, so from the keyboard, for example, reading commands or inputs from the keyboard. All of these need privileged instructions, and they need to run in kernel mode. So that's a summary of that. And then how do we, let's say in C or even in assembly, how do we do this kernel mode? What's the mechanism? How do we actually implement it as users? Oh, you have a question?
I thought you were asking a question.
Oh yeah, you want to answer, please go ahead.
I would imagine that that's what you use pseudo for when you're like in the terminal.
No. We'll speak just in a few minutes about that.
Okay.
But the way to do that is to follow a convention. When we want to have this kernel mode system call, we want to do a system call. We want to ask the system to handle some work that needs all this elevated privilege, right? Privileged instructions. So each operating system has a convention on how this is done. And there is a special instruction, something called system. And it will have a certain format. For example, it will look at some specific registers. So for example, we will set the RAX register to a value. This is gonna be the system call number. This will be the type of system call. For example, number one means standard input output. Number two means something else, a disk or so. And we'll see actually soon an example of that. But this number is the type of system call. There are not like an infinity of them. There are a limited number of type of system calls. And then we will also set the values of these other registers. And then we will run system call, the instruction itself. And it will take all those values and it will understand what actually needs to happen. And we'll look at an example soon. Now if it returns a minus one after the system call, I think that's an error. So you could think of it as a function call, but so it has arguments and there is a return, but we don't really do a jump. Now for a function, you have a call, you call something, you go from one location to another with a program counter. With the system call, that's not how it works. So here is the example for hello world. So we have this data, hello world. And the first instruction is we move the value 1 in RAX. It so happens that 1 means write. That's the system call that we're doing. We're doing a write. Okay? Now, okay, we're writing, but there are other things. Where are we writing? Or, you know, the write has some other attributes. And one of them is it looks in the register RDI, and we're writing a 1 there, and that means we're writing to standard out, STD out. Okay, so that makes sense. We're doing a write. So we're setting RAX to 1 to do a write. We're setting another 1 to RDI to write to STD out. Okay, what are we writing? We're writing hello world, basically, and we're setting that into RSI. Basically, that will go there. Hello string. And how much are we writing? We're writing 15 characters. And we're putting that into RDX. And then the next instruction is syscall. When we run that instruction, it will look at the values in the previous registers we wrote, and it will understand what needs to happen. Okay, that value is 1, I need to do a write. That other value is also 1, I'm writing to standard output. I'm writing the hello world, it's 15 characters. It will just happen. And after that, there's another system call. We're writing a 60 into RAX, that means exit, and then a 0 into RDI, system call, and that returns 0. So this was maybe a hello world function, and it did a system call to write hello world, and then it did another system call to exit. And what I want to mention about C, when we run system calls in C, we can't really just run them directly in our function. We also, we don't have this, so similar how there were intrinsic functions for vector instructions, you would think that there would be intrinsic functions for system calls, but actually what happens is we have wrappers for assembly. We have assembly wrappers. So somebody already wrote some assembly, for example, write, printf, somebody, well, printf, subroutine of printf. Somebody wrote some assembly which includes the system calls. So the compiler won't really generate the instructions to do the system calls. What we are doing is we are using previously defined assembly code that is wrapped into C. And for example, we have this routine here, write, that we, and this will call that assembly code that we just saw before. So here is that question about sudo. When we do sudo, does it give us kernel writes? No. Whenever we, with or without sudo, programs are always run in user mode, not in kernel mode. But when we do sudo, the operating system might allow us extra privileges. For example, we will do it with sudo. Perhaps that means you can access this I/O, this specific I/O, or this location in the file system. Yeah, or execute this program that otherwise is not allowed. We're somewhat running out of time. I'm sorry, I'll skip this. Because I want us to cover address translation. Let's see how the memory mapping actually happens and how it is done. And there are many ways to do it, but a lot of the times, or most commonly, it's done in this way. So we'll look at this one most common approach. So we have a process A that has this illusion of its own memory. So it issues a memory request to do a read or write to the memory. And this read or write, it wants it to go like physically to the cache hierarchy, to the memory hierarchy. Before it even reaches the cache, it has to be translated. So the operating system will take this memory request and will do a little bit of translation to convert it from a virtual memory access to physical memory access. So it's a little bit difficult. I would just have to have a table. So every address accessed, instruction or end data, so not just data, even for instructions, right? Let's skip that. So the operating system will convert it, will map it from virtual to physical. But how will this work? In what format? Where is it stored? In the processor? In the memory? Here is a very simple example. We have a physical memory, and we are dividing this in four quarters. 0, 1, 2. And we are also trying to make our life very convenient. We are dividing, so we're segmenting this in equally sized quarters. Same size. Yeah, all of them. Same size. And another convenience we are choosing is to make this a power of 2. 1 kilobyte, 1 megabyte. And we call each of these pages, and we actually call them virtual pages. And this will be our virtual page index, 0, 1, 2, 3. And because we are going with a power 2 size, we are able to use the most significant bits of this address that the program uses as the virtual page index. Do you agree? Questions about that? So this is 0, 0 over there. This is 1, 1 over there. 2, and 3. And then the remaining bits are the offset. So if we want to add access, for example, an address that is 10.1100.0101. First we look at this ones, these two bits, 10. So that will probably be somewhere here, right? In this virtual page number 2. And where will it be? Well, we have these other offsets that we can look inside this virtual page. So 1, 1, probably somewhere up there. That's the 1 byte we want to access, or 64 bytes. Okay, here we have a similar, just went with the physical address with 8 segments instead of 4. And our physical index now will have 3 bits. But in terms of virtual addresses, we still have only 2. Because we have... So previously we were looking at only virtual. Sorry, so this was all virtual, right? Virtual pages. And now we're also looking at physical. So this one's at the virtual addresses. And now we are also looking at physical. And so physical, we also can segment it into this, like before we segmented it into equal pages. Likewise, we do that for the physical address, physical memory, we segment it into this physical pages. And I am pretty sure that they should be of the same size, but don't trust me. Yeah, they should be the same size. Yeah, so this page, you want it to have all the data from this virtual page should be able to fit in that physical page. I guess we could put some wasteful data in between, but there is really no, it's just complicated. There's no reason to do that. Then we can map, and we don't have to do a uniform map, we can just map. Quite in an inconsistent way. So this virtual page can map to that physical page, this other virtual page can map to that physical page over there. And how do we know what maps how? Well, we use a table. And this is our table, and we call that our page table. So that we have a name for it. A lot of names, right? We have virtual addresses, virtual pages, then we have physical addresses, physical pages, and then we have a page table that maps virtual pages to physical pages. But in the end, it does what we want. It will give each of our programs some pages in the physical. So it will give us a virtual memory in the physical memory. So let's see. We have this virtual page 0, which is this one here, right? This one here. And it maps to the second, to this index here. Okay, great. Then this other one, 01, maps to 111. So that's that one there. Perfect. Now the third one maps to none. How do we handle that? One way to handle that is to have a valid bit. Is that virtual page valid or not? If it's not valid, it means it doesn't have a mapping in the page table. So similar like we did in the cache table, we had a valid bit. We can have that here as well, and that does the job. And let's go through a lookup. So in this case, we would like to access this address that the CPU wants to act to make this access, and we know that this is our virtual page index, and then that's our offset. Right? So that's our offset. That's our virtual page index, DPI. And first we're gonna be looking, okay, this is 0, 1, this is this one right here. Second, we're looking, okay, it's valid, great. So then what is the physical page index? Oh, it's 1, 1, 1. So we take this 1, 1, 1, and that will be the most significant bits of the physical page we want, the address in the physical memory, right? Of the physical page we want to access. And then the offset, it just simply, we concatenate with the offset. The offset corresponds, right? We have the same size, virtual and physical pages, same size. So if we want to byte at a certain offset, we do the same in the physical memory. And if it's not valid, we will trigger an exception. And this address now will go to the memory hierarchy. So it will go to the cache. So between the memory stage of your processor implementation, processor pipeline, and the cache, we're gonna have this page table. Yeah, so I'll repeat that. So we had our processor pipeline. I'll actually spend some time drawing. So we had, what was it? Fetch, decode, execute, memory, and write back. So the memory was interfacing with the cache, right? With the data cache in that case. Data cache, level one cache. So now it won't just go directly, it will go through a page table that will have this two fields, well, three fields, also divided. This will be the patch page table, right there. That's where it's located.
One more time.
What about fetch?
Similar, except it will go to instruction level one. But similar, it will also have to go through the page table. So if we want to modify the page table, can we just do that? Can the program do that? If a program could do that, then a program could say, instead of accessing this physical page, I'm gonna access another one. And that's a security risk. So that will trigger pretty severe, I think, exception. You need the privileged instructions to do that, and that probably can be done with the operating system. Where in the is the code that is switching? So then, if we would like, if that has to happen, then in the operating system, there should be a code that allows us to do that. Because we do need to change the page table. Say we're making a new process, a new program. We're starting a new task. Then we have to create virtual memory for that new program. So we have to edit the page table. And there has to be a program that knows how to edit this page table. So where is the program located? Probably also in the memory, in one of the physical pages. And how do we access it? We have to go again through this page table. So the hope is that, and it has to be basically a kernel mode only program, part of the operating system that allows us to update, to modify our page table. But at first, when we start a machine, an operating system, there is no single program in it running, no single process. And as it boots, we log in, there are lots of services, lots of processes starting up. So all of them will be assigned some virtual memory, and the operating system will start editing the page table. And it will end up being a very large page table. And this last example is if two users on Portal, both of them open Emacs. It's the same program. Do we want to create copies of the program in different places in memory? So that would be one way to do it. But if a lot of people run the same program, it would be more efficient to just use the same memory. So use the same page, and that is possible. So that is definitely possible. But what if a user modifies, so a user writing Emacs might want to, so if you're running a program, any program, say the program that you just coded, and someone else is also writing that program, that same program, you can modify your own program, right? You have the right to edit it, to change something in it, to insert one more instruction. You have all the right to do that, to edit it with anything. But if two users are running that, that same program, then you might end up inserting a risk or a security risk to the other user. In this case, maybe you will damage or you will modify Emacs, and all the users running Emacs will all of a sudden have to basically be unable to run Emacs because you just modified it, you just damaged Emacs. So imagine you do that. So that is why, so to prevent that from happening, in addition to having valid bits, we also have this other three bits. We have a kernel bit, a write bit, and an execute bit. And so for each, for this virtual or physical pages, these are flags, and they before reading or writing or executing, the operating system will check, does this user have the privilege to do that? Yes, Charles, go ahead.
The hardware
will check. Yeah, even better. So the hardware will check, does the user or is these instructions that are coming to do something to this physical page, either read or write or execute from it, do these instructions have the rights or the privileges? Do they match? Do they meet this expectation? So are they with kernel? And in this case, we have zeros, but if one of them would be one, then only the kernel would be able to do that, to basically, only the kernel would be able to read or write or do anything to that page, to access that page. So that page, in that way, we can dedicate a page only to kernel mode. Similarly, write one or zero. By setting a page write one or zero, we will not be able, a user mode will not be able to write to the to that physical page. And last is execute, but I'm actually not sure what that entirely means. But I was hoping to start next time from here. Another question.
So can more than one user have the privilege?
One more time, please.
Can more than one user have the privilege to...
Can one, more than one user... yes. Yes, I believe so. It's possible for... Yes, go ahead.
This is the page table. So each process has its own. So the OS can set them up for different users in different ways if they want to, or the same way. But the OS decides that sets up the page table, where it puts the right...
Yes, So these are writes, these are like access limits for or expectations that a user, a program has to have to access that physical page. So to access this last one, it has to be valid, and we can write to it. And a user will actually be able to do that. It can always read from it. For example, from the other one, it can only read. And yeah, multiple users can do that.
Well, like, as you said, like if multiple users have the privilege to do like one like write at the same time without crash the process.
I see. Some pages, more users can access them. Other pages are restricted to... So we can map more physical pages.
So I think what you're just saying, your question is, if we have multiple users, how does this work? So this is an page table for one program.
Yes.
And if we have multiple processes, there are multiple page tables.
Yeah.
Okay.
And there's nothing restricting what's in these page tables other than what the OS chooses. So the OS can choose to have two, three different page tables that all give the same physical page number.
So this one role can be for multiple problems.
So like multiple users will have multiple page tables.
Yes. Yes. Multiple processes for the same user.
But they can have the same entry.
They
can have the same entry.
You ask for whatever wants in these entries.
Yeah, they don't have to be exclusive. They can have. They can share something.
I think what you were going to say is that this is not a user
over time.
Stop
the recording.
And yeah.